Welcome to Making and Breaking Social Policy, a podcast about how we respond to big social issues and what this means for social and community practice. My name is Ben Lohmeyer, and I'm a lecturer and researcher in social work at Flinders University. Today's special guest is Dr. Camilla Bastin, and we are going to have a conversation about her research on being child-centered in child protection. Camilla is a lecturer and researcher at Flinders University and part of the Social Work Innovation Research Living Space. She is responsible for the child protection portfolio within social work, and her teaching responsibilities predominantly fall on teaching social work knowledge and skill development in working with children. Camilla has over 20 years' experience in the field of child protection and human services as a professional social work practitioner and academic. She has worked in government and non-government organisations nationally and internationally, including as a senior advisor to the Deputy Chief Executive at the Department for Child Protection in South Australia. Camilla's PhD research is titled The Moral Status of Children in Child Protection, The Case for Emerging from Our Moral Ignorance, and was engaged in a philosophical deliberation asserting that children are valuable members of the human community, illuminating the criticality of relationships, rights, and obligations. We recognise that Flinders Social Work operates on the traditional lands and waters of the Kaurna peoples, and we pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. We acknowledge their sovereignty and continued responsibility to care for country. Camilla, thank you so much for joining me today for this conversation. You recently published a paper with Sarah Wendt and Priscilla Dunk-West entitled Being Child-Centered, Factors That Facilitate Professional Judgment and Decision-Making in Child Protection. I think it was published in Child and Family Social Work. Is that right?
That's right. Yes.
Great. So this was a really interesting paper to read through, and I kind of want to start by just asking you to tell us a little bit more about the project. What is it you were doing? How did it come about? Who you speak to? All those things.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me, Ben. This is very exciting to be part of your podcast series, and it's a great initiative to support student learning, but also to enhance knowledge in relation to the processes involved in promoting change in social work and in our areas of expertise. So I'll take you a little bit on a journey that happened in developing this project. So the project has its roots in my practice experience as a child protection practitioner, and then followed by my PhD research. So as a social worker in child protection, I always was challenged by the systemic responses to children. So child protection was established and continues to operate on the basis that it is to protect children. However, it's a system that does not always promote or hear the voices of children, nor does the system always make them visible.
Yeah, okay.
So this theme of invisibility and silence of children and young people also emerged from my PhD research, and is a constant theme in child protection inquiries, child death reviews, and coronial inquiries examining child deaths.
So when you, sorry to interrupt, but when you're saying silencing invisible from young people, do you mean that they're just literally not heard very often by the system?
They're not heard, and we'll talk a little bit more in a bit later, but in terms of, it is a system that has a lot of voices that you need to hear.
Yeah, okay.
And trying to balance those voices with also making sure you hear the voice of the child, sometimes it ends up being that the loudest voices are heard.
Makes sense.
And the people with the least power, which is children and young people who are disadvantaged and have experienced trauma, are the least heard. Which is really something that I've always strived and wanted to make sense of.
Okay.
And I guess it came from a very early experience in my social work career. I was working with a young man who had experienced chronic emotional abuse in his biological family, and he found his voice and actually asked to not live with his family anymore because he was tired of and could no longer cope with the trauma that he was experiencing.
Wow.
So he made a move to leave his family, established himself in living with his extended family, but then for some reason he was no longer supported in doing that and found himself having to move back home.
Oh, wow.
So my supervisor at the time decided that there was no longer any need for us to be working with him, and I tried to advocate that because he'd moved back home, he was at risk and he needed that support. But I was overruled, and as a young, or I should say inexperienced practitioner, because sure. I'm not so young, I had to follow the directions of my supervisor, sure. and at the time, not knowing how to challenge that. So I had to close the case. I spoke to him. You know, we talked about other resources and other services that he could use. He was 16 at the time. So, and a few weeks later, he actually committed suicide.
Oh, no.
So, for me, that was an experience that, you know, really challenged my commitment to be a social worker, but mm-hmm. it really showed me that the system is not always in favour or listens to the needs of children or young people.
Wow.
So that's really driven me as in my work and has led me to where I am right now.
Yeah. Wow. That's a hugely powerful story and makes a lot of sense of the lack of voice, the invisibility or silencing of young people and their needs. In a system that has multiple priorities.
Absolutely. And that was a priority because, you know, there's never enough resources to meet the needs of all the children and young people that come into the system. But that's probably an extreme outcome, one that I, you know, never want to want any social worker to have to experience. But I think it shows that when we don't listen or we silence young people, that it can have really serious consequences.
Yeah. Thank you.
So just going back to the journey about getting this project going, just before Swirls was established, some of the staff decided to apply for a grant examining social work professional judgment and decision making.
Right.
Sarah, Priscilla and I opted to examine professional judgment in the context of child protection. So I had really strong connections and was able to engage with the senior people within the Department for Child Protection. But we decided that we didn't wish to focus on the problems about practice, where practice isn't child-centred, but to take an appreciative inquiry approach where we engage with practitioners to find out what they do and what works for them and how they ensure that their practice is child-centred. So so that the children that, and young people they work with are central to their decision-making and professional judgment. Mm-hmm. So children are seen and heard.
Great.
So engaging with practitioners at the front line and focusing on what works is a research approach that is really critical to Swirl's mandate. Yeah. So it's about building evidence about what works. So it's really a positive approach to research, if you like, rather than constantly identifying the problems or the deficits that are in the system.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It's quite a deliberate choice to say, okay, we're going to try and build strengths rather than find problems.
Yeah.
It's interesting, a part of this topic is about understanding the way the social issues are framed within social policy.
Yeah.
And sometimes the way that different disciplines can bring a particular knowledge to the framing of that issue.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that here you're pointing out to us quite a deliberate choice in the way that you're framing the issue. We're going to look for strengths rather than kind of look for deficits. Yeah.
And I think that's a real the methodology that Swirls really promotes is because, you know, if we look at child protection or many areas in social work is that, you know, through reports and inquiries and coronial inquiries, we constantly hear the problems. Mm. What we don't hear is situations where from practitioners or knowledge or practice wisdom from practitioners about what actually works for them. Mm. Because, you know, practitioners constantly hearing what they do wrong is really, you know, leads them to a real risk-averse approach where they don't feel confident in what they're doing. However, hearing what they do well is really a way of promoting their practice wisdom and their practice knowledge.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. You're going to have to tell us a little bit more at some stage. It doesn't have to be now, but what you mean by practice wisdom.
Okay, yep.
Again, that idea that there are different kinds of ways of knowing or different knowledges is really important for how we think about the issue that we want to discover. And I really like that you've already highlighted if we look at negatives all the time, we promote a risk-averse way of thinking about issues, but also think way of doing practice. So we want to avoid what we're doing wrong all the time rather than try and say, okay, here's the strength, let's build on them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's great. Thank you.
And I guess it's the same as when we work with families though, isn't it? In our, you know, when we start off as social workers, we know that as social workers, our mandate is about change and constantly focusing on the negatives that exist in some families or with the people that we work only will demoralise them or disempower them, whereas we need to find those strengths and protective mechanisms that then will help them enact that change. So it's a very, you know, it's that empowerment and mandate to implement change. So
that's great.
But we will talk, you know, I have got some discussion there about practice wisdom.
We'll come back to that. Thank you.
So what we did with the research, we started to have conversations or with people within the Department for Child Protection. They were very supportive of the research because their practice framework, one of the important pillars is child-centred practice. So they were keen for us to engage with practitioners. So first of all, we sought the authorisation of senior staff in the Child Protection Agency, which involved meeting with the CEO and other staff. So we needed their endorsement, essentially, to carry out the research. And then during these conversations, the department were particularly keen for us to interview staff who work with children, young people in out-of-home care. So if you like, it's not the front end of child protection, but it's more the back end, if you like, or where, you know, workers work with children who are in long-term care.
Right.
Yeah, so these, they're children, young people who cannot live with their biological families for whatever reason. So they might be in foster care, family-based foster care, kinship care, or residential care. So the next stage involved then meeting with managers and senior staff in the relevant offices and seek their endorsement and ensure the research was value-adding to their work. Because what you want to promote in research is about adding value to their work rather than just adding a burden, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
So we had very positive response from many of the staff. And I think one of the things the staff really valued is that we weren't going to focus on the problem, that we were going to consult with them or seek their knowledge about what they do that works and draw out how they navigate complexity in being child-centred. So I think, so then we set up interviews, we got ethics proposal, but I think one of the things that I found in interviewing the practitioners, we had 50 practitioners in 4 focus groups, and one of the things I found, it was an opportunity for that reflective practice, for people to really take that time to think about, you know, their work that they actually engage in. Yeah.
That makes sense. Wow. It's a fascinating project and there's so many bits to it. I'm looking forward to the rest of our conversation. There's one bit I kind of want to pick up on, which is sometimes in this conversation about social issues and social problems and policy, and particularly the framework that we use in this subject, which is an analysis framework called what's the problem represented to be, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's this very problem focus in all of the conversation that we're having around that, whereas you've taken, as we've already highlighted, quite a deliberate strengths focus and asking people what works and we want to build in that way. And I think that's really important for us to keep in mind as a kind of tenet of social work research.
Yeah.
Because as you mentioned before, we want to give people resources that are useful, not just burden them with more problems.
Yeah.
But also as an important way of framing the whole conversation. You know, it's not just about what the problem is. This equally solutions that we might come up with are framed by the knowledges that we draw on the conversations we have. So thank you for highlighting that. Can you take us into kind of the next bit of what we want to talk about by telling us a little bit about your findings, you know, factors that you found that influenced child-centered decision-making and professional judgment?
Yep. Okay. So what we found was that the practitioners clearly articulated what it means to be child-centred. So sometimes there's this discourse about people don't know what they're doing in child protection, they're not very skilled, they don't have the knowledge. But when we started the conversation, we started with a very, you know, basic question about, well, what is it to, you know, what does it mean to you to be child-centred? And it, we got very clear responses, very knowledgeable responses. So, and what, you know, we found was that there were many dynamic and interacting factors that were necessary. So it wasn't one thing that the practitioners talked about. It was actually multiple things that worked together to then support practitioners to be child-centred. So the first one that was highlighted was that it was important for practitioners to have a very formal knowledge and understanding of the theories about child development, children's rights, trauma theory, and relationship-based practice. So these theories were considered essential requirements and influential in being child-centred and making decisions so that children are visible and heard. So the foundation of such that formal knowledge ensured that practitioners are able to conduct assessments, develop interventions that are developmentally attuned and responsive to the needs of children and young people.
Right.
And then there was a foundation of that grounded their understanding of children that informed their expertise and provide evidence. So, for example, you know, there was clear recognition that how you work with a child or make decisions about a child that's 5 years of age is going to be quite different to how you interact, build relationships and make decisions with a child who's 15. Mm. So you really need to recognise those developmental differences.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. So the other theme that really came through was the importance of relationships. That was really a dominant theme right through the research. So the ability to build relationships was critical in being responsive and being attuned to the needs of children, young people. But through relationships, the practitioners get to know the needs and wishes of children, and then they have the ability to advocate for them. So if they know them, they build those relationships and they can actually be a voice for them in decision making. So establishing relationships was really the bedrock for implementing change and achieving those positive outcomes. However, it can also be challenging in the context of high workload and demands. Through the building of relationships, there's trust, there is understanding of children, young people's experiences, and it's also demonstrative of, you know, respect for the children's and young people's individuality and their rights. So these factors were really important.
They're really interesting kind of two in and of themselves factors. And they're almost, at least on a surface level, contrasting kind of starting points, right?
Yep.
So you have the broad knowledge and theories that are often built on large data sets and long-term studies and you know, ideas that have been passed down over a long period of time, as compared to the contextual in-person, in-the-moment information that you get out of an individual young person.
Yeah.
I can imagine that even just holding those two, and I'm sure we're going to tell them about more in a tick, is a really hard task.
Yeah, it is a hard task. So it's that real, and this is, you know, in teaching emerging social workers in my topic, it's about you need to have that formal knowledge that we gain from other disciplines and also from our social work theories. But then you also need to have those skills to be able to build relationships, connect with people, but also connect in a way that's developmentally appropriate.
Mm.
And if people don't feel comfortable with children and young people, that can be really challenging, or they're not familiar with that process, then that's something they really need to learn very quickly.
Makes sense.
So having worked with some teenagers, they require quite a specific approach, and you need to understand who they are, really.
Absolutely. Yep. That can be a different skill set.
Yes, they can, a very different skill set. So the other point that I wanted to make was that practice wisdom and practice experience is another form of really critical knowledge that informs intuitive reasoning. So so through experience, practitioners develop a practice wisdom about what works and what doesn't in their interactions with children, young people, and in their practice. So intuitive reasoning is more than having formal knowledge, but it really, so it doesn't come from books, but it is knowledge that's built over time and the ability to link theories to practice. So it's that knowledge that you gain through experience, through that interaction with children, young people, and you recognize what works and what doesn't. So, for example, working with a child who's 5 or 6, you might get more building that relationship might be through, you know, having some papers and some crayons to sit and get them to, you know, engage with them in that way or through play. Whereas with a 15-year-old, I always found sitting down over a meal and over food was a much better approach. So it's about developing your own way, but also building your expertise through that experience.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You've articulated that really clearly, but at the same time, I get the sense that it's still quite a ephemeral, kind of ungraspable thing. You know, it comes out of so much of who a person is as much as what, like you said, you might read in a book.
Yeah, I think it's not something, practice wisdom is not something that's really tangible, but it does build over time in your practice. It's through experience that you then think intuitively or you have those gut feelings about, you know, what is right in this situation and what's going to work.
Sure.
So it's a really embodied approach to work. It can be also emotionally informed, but it does come through practice experience.
Mm-hmm.
Not something that you leave university with, but you build up over time.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Another big theme in this podcast is about the ways that social policy makes and breaks social work practice, but also in reverse, right? So the way social work practice and human services practice more generally
yeah.
kind of makes and breaks the policy. In this instance, I can see how, you know, an idea that might be really clear in a policy when translated into practice won't work because of the individual instances that you engage with a young person or a child and your own style. And so a practitioner might know that their practice wisdom is kind of going to break that policy. It's not going to, you're not going to work in the way that it was expected yep. to because of their practice wisdom, their experience of engaging with people in yep. the real world.
Yeah, and I think there's an argument that policies should be, particularly in a field like social work or working with people, is that they should be developed, informed by practice wisdom. So, so it's not that, you know, it's really challenges that top-down approach in developing policies and procedures, but it's that real bottom-up approach as well. So you need both to make sure that you get it right. So
that makes sense.
It's quite yeah. interesting. So the other factor that emerged from the research was that organisational factors are also necessary to support child-centred decision making. So some of those factors include things like access to resources, the use of clear procedures and processes, because that does provide a frame for your work. But the participants also stated that having access to reflective spaces through supervision and through a supportive team culture sustained their ability to be child-centred. Because as you can imagine, working in child protection is extremely challenging work emotionally. So having that ability to reflect and talk to your colleagues is really important, because people said that was probably one of the most important things that sustained them in the work. Because if they didn't have a supportive team culture, then they didn't think they could do that work.
Mm.
So they needed opportunities to talk, make sense of situations, and really debrief when necessary.
That makes sense.
But also working within a care team approach. So one of the things that we found in the Department for Child Protection, they have a care team that wraps around the child or young person who's in care. So that includes anyone that's involved in the life of the child. So it could be professionals, could be the foster parents, social workers, to then meet on a regular basis. So it's a real collaborative approach to decision-making. And in that decision-making process is that the young people would, their views would be part of that process too.
Right, yeah. Okay. So that's where we're bringing in kind of the point that you highlighted at the start about young people being silenced or being invisible is deliberately creating a space for their voice to be heard.
Yes. And they might not themselves be part, you know, be present during those care meetings, but the social workers, you know, will consult with the young person, say we're having a care meeting, you know, ask them questions, make sure that their views or interests are met within that care meeting. So there's someone advocating for them, and deliberately consulting with them if they can't. You know, obviously older, you know, young people would be invited to attend those care meetings, which is some of them feel confident to do that, others don't. But the important thing is that their voice is heard through someone advocating.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, I imagine rocking up to a care meeting that is about me would actually be really, really confronting.
Absolutely,
so, yeah. I might not actually want to be there.
That's right. Yeah. But I guess, you know, the young people, children would know all these people because they're working with them.
True.
And it's part of it is about being supportive and to make decisions that are about the well-being and the safety of the child and young person. Yeah.
Right.
So I think one of the things that really came out of the research was that decision-making and professional judgment for young people is fundamentally relational. So it doesn't occur in isolation, that it occurs with others. So the care team approach, the reflective spaces, support with a resilient team culture and building relationships really sustains the ability of practitioners to navigate the complexities in child protection.
Yeah, wow. Okay. So there are quite a few different factors for us to think about there that come together to inform what this work looks like in the real world.
Yeah.
And sometimes all that complexity isn't as clear as at a policy level or even just kind of a dominant way of thinking about the issue of, in this case, child protection.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about what are some of those kind of dominant ways of thinking, dominant discourses in the space that have shaped or directed practice and research? And how do we maybe start to think differently about
it? Yeah. So I think one of the things that doesn't always come through inquiries is really that working in child protection is really complex and difficult work.
Mm.
And it is complex and difficult work because practitioners are witnesses to some of the darker side of humanity and suffering that exists in our work and in our community.
Yeah.
So some of the experiences that children have does not paint humanity in a good light.
No.
So
that's to put it mildly. Thank you.
Yeah. No, well, I think that's the reality of it. And not to shy away from that either, because if you're working in child protection, you are witness to that darkness and suffering.
Yeah.
And how you manage that or navigate that is really critical, and how the organisation supports their workers to do that. So as social workers, we have an ethical and moral responsibility to not only respond to those experiences, but alleviate it and bring hope into the people's lives with whom we work. So our profession is about change. So we must strive through research, practice, teaching to make that system better. So some of the dominant discourses over the years have been fairly deficit focus. So since the 1800s, child protection developed to protect children. But now we have systems nationally and internationally that are extremely complex and dominated by political, economic, and neoliberalist agendas in an attempt to really control and surveil people who harm children. And also, you know, monitor the work that social workers engage in working with families. So with never-ending reviews in the child protection system, reviews of child death inquiries, there's a real push to try and minimise risk, to reduce the number of deaths or critical events that occur due to children, young people not receiving adequate services. So what happens is that these complex systems have been dominated by high-level bureaucracies and procedures, which prevents practitioners from engaging with and building relationships. So to try and manage that risk, it actually takes social workers away or practitioners away from actually spending time with children. So it has that opposite effect, in fact.
So that's really interesting because I don't think anyone on the surface level would disagree with the idea of managing the risks of
protecting
children. But can you tell us maybe a little bit more about how we think about the risks, or you know, what is it about neoliberalism or that surveillance approach versus a social work approach to risk?
Yeah. So I think what happens in organisations that are, that manage high risk, so mental health organisations that work with people who experience mental illness, child protection, also criminal justice system, is you want to reduce the incidence of adverse or critical incidents occurring, so deaths or, you know, people committing crimes or children dying, you know. So what happens is that to try and minimise that risk, there are more rules or procedures that are put in place. So, and with neoliberalist agendas and managerialist agendas, it's about bureaucracies imposing those rules to then control the work. So the more work, administrative work, that workers actually have, it increases their demands or their workload. So they spend more time filling in forms or, you know, responding to bureaucratic needs that then takes them away from actually spending time with children or young people or building relationships. And that has been, a real tension in these organisations because social workers want to, you know, most social workers are in the business because they want to be with people, work with people, but then they've also got the demands of the organisation, also professional demands around, you know, accountability, writing up reports, assessments, filling in paperwork, that then really cause that tension.
That makes sense, yeah. Yeah, there's very few of our students who I've met who've come in and said, I just really am looking forward to, you know, writing up the reports. Usually it's about, I want to engage with the people.
Yeah.
And so I think you're right, that's where they start. The other thing that I was thinking about as you were talking with some of the agendas for managing risk is the other bit that goes with that is often it's about managing efficiencies as well. So it's you have to have processes that not only prevent risk but also demonstrate clearly that you prevent that risk and you have a documented trail for the risk that you've managed. And so it's not just about preventing risk, it's about the process of preventing risk.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. So I think, over the last 20 to 30 years, there's been, a real drive in child protection to have risk assessment instruments. And there's a lot of tick boxing, which really they're there to guide people or practitioners to think about areas that should be assessing. But one of the critiques or this unintended consequences is that there has been an over-reliance on tick box, ticking the boxes, without informing or upskilling workers about, well, why are you ticking that box? What is the basis for you to do that? What a knowledge underpins the, you know, why underpins the reason why you're ticking that box. So, you know, Munro in her real seminal work said that it really does take people away from thinking about the work that they're doing. And social workers stopped really engaging in that reflective professional decision-making approach but just relied on paperwork or risk assessments.
Yeah, that's really great.
Whereas there's a movement now to try and encourage people to, yes, recognise that's part of the work, but, you know, why are you making that, you know, be accountable and why are people making particular decisions?
Yeah, great. So part of what I'm hearing that in that and what you've described as this complex interplay of factors that influence child centered decision making is that do we imagine social workers to be these professionals who have the capacity to make those complex decisions with informed by all those factors? Or are they essentially, I don't know, accountants, like, oh, or something else, you know, there's actually people who
bureaucrats.
Just manage, bureaucrats is probably better. Do they just manage the process, tick the box, and then we know we're done?
Yeah.
You know, they're very different pictures of the kind of service being offered.
Yeah.
And therefore that's almost, to use that problem language again, you know, how we imagine the problem is and how we respond to it.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that came through in the research is that they are, you know, we didn't hear a lot about the demands of paperwork. They really talked through the importance of spending time with children and young people and trying to manage the tensions. And they really articulated quite well that, yes, they do have to do the paperwork, but, you know, the children and young people are the most important part of their work. And they really, you know, they were really very committed and dedicated to making sure that happened. They talked about a process that is in legislation around annual review process, but they saw that even though it could be cumbersome in terms of the workload demands or the paperwork that goes along with that, that it is a real opportunity to reflect on what's happened for the child and young person, but then also looking forward as well. So they saw it as a positive process that needed to be done.
Yeah, great. Yep. Okay. The process still has value. That's excellent. You've been really generous with your time so far. I realise we're coming to the end of it, so I better ask you the next question.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. Yeah.
Which is about, well, what does this all mean, right? At the end of the day, when we have, you know, policies that are in place in this, and, you know, child protection is in place with quite a few different policies.
A lot of policies.
And then we're speaking to potential future practitioners, the students who are listening, but there may be some people who are already working in this field as well.
Yep.
So what does this all mean? What do we do with your research now we have it?
Well, that's an interesting question and one that I always, you know, think about quite a bit and, you know, how does this research actually contribute to change in the system? So child-centred practice is, it really pervades many organisational practice frameworks that work with children and families, but it's sometimes viewed as quite simplistic, but in actual fact it's really complex. And I don't want people to shy away from child protection work because I think it is extremely valuable work and it is something that, you know, if you can work in child protection, then I think you can work anywhere.
Sure.
It's really, I think, great work and worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want you to picture a scenario, which isn't unusual if you work in child protection. So you work with a child who lives in a context characterised by domestic and family violence, substance abuse and homelessness and isolation. So you're working with the child. You need to understand who they are, their development, their experiences. So you work with the children, but you also need to understand the parents, their experiences and the risk and how that impacts on the child's safety. And as a social worker, you've got other parts of the system that you need to consider. So if they're, you know, you might have lawyers, you might have other professionals. So you've got a lot of people to really think about. And and a part of that, you need to listen. You need to make sure the voice of the child's heard.
Mm.
So being child-centred is complex. But I think one of the things is that workers in practice, to be ethical and child-centred, is for organisations to have a responsibility to ensure that their workers are cared for, nurtured and provided with adequate resources to do their work. So organisations and professional bodies have a responsibility to ensure that practitioners have access to professional development opportunities so their knowledge is up to date. They have the space and time to form relationships with children, young people and their families, and that they work in a context where they can engage in reflexivity in a safe and supportive culture. So in a nutshell, I think the important message is that if we want children to be visible and heard in contexts of complexity, then we need to make sure that practitioners have all they need professionally, emotionally, and practically to engage in that practice, to be child-centered. So if they are, you know, provided with everything they need, then they have the space and the capability to make sure that children, young people are well and cared for. Child-centered practice requires a systems response. It should not be left to the individual practitioner. And I think there's a real misunderstanding that being child-centered is that you just work with the child and the young person, but that's not the case. You've got to work with, you know, all parts of the system, but you need to also navigate how you make sure that child's voice is heard. So practitioners have a responsibility to ensure that they engage in professional development opportunities so their knowledge and skills are up to date. However, managers and senior people in organisation need to foster an organisation, a learning organisation that's replete in reflective spaces. There are clear practice guidance that promotes professional judgment, supportive team environments, and access to those practical and financial resources. It's on this basis then that workforce will have the capacity to be confident and work with children and young people.
Yeah, well, thank you. And that's really interesting, I think, the way you talk about it as a system response.
So absolutely.
I'm imagining, like, the popular idea when we think about things like child protection is there's a list of rules somewhere that says we intervene in these instances that describe the problem that a young person might be experiencing. And I'm sure some version of that exists somewhere, right? but what you're saying is that that's not enough, because just saying what the young person experiences or the rules about when to intervene ignores the practitioners who need to have the capacity to respond in an appropriate way to that. So you actually have to design not just when to intervene, but the whole system of intervention around how we care for young people in appropriate ways. And so that's your center starting point, but you've got to divide this whole process around that includes practitioners as well. It's a very different picture of the problem of child protection than you would popularly think about it.
Yeah. So I think, you know, ideally we need to develop a system that is child-centred. We need to think about what is it that children, young people need. So they need, you know, we know that they need important relationships, they need opportunities to thrive, and then you start to, well, what do families need to make sure that children have those? And then you have to have systems that are there to support families to then look after children, which is a different way of thinking.
It is a different way of thinking. Yes. Thank you. I think that can be just the takeaway message from our chat. Think about this problem a little bit differently. Thank you so much. Before you go, you do have to tell us a little bit maybe about what you're working on at the moment. You know, what's come next after doing this project?
Okay. So I guess being a member of SWIRLS, I'm really fortunate enough to be in a research environment, and I'm a member of a team member of quite a few research projects. But I guess and I'm an early career researcher, so one of the things that's building my narrative as a researcher, which is slowly evolving. But I guess I'm involved in several projects that focus on understanding cultural safety and wellbeing for Aboriginal children and young people. And a real, you know, the importance of that is that we work alongside Aboriginal people to inform that research. So we're not driving the research, we're more facilitating the voices of Aboriginal practitioners.
Wow.
And they're driving the research. So that's really important. And involved in some projects, we're improving outcomes at the intersection of domestic violence and child protection. So that's really important work.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But finally, one thing I do want to plug is that we've got quite a few projects where we're looking at workforce development. So lately I have a national survey that's currently active, focusing on understanding what are the professional development needs of practitioners who work with children and families who experience complexity. So it'd be great if people could take time to fill in the survey, and it's open till the end of September, and it's on the SWIRLS website.
Great, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes of this podcast as well.
That would be great. Thanks, Ben.
Easy. Thank you so much for coming in and having a chat. If people wanted to find out more about all these incredible projects you're working on the interwebs somewhere, where would they find you? How would we connect with you or stalk you or whatever?
Well, they can follow me on Twitter.
Great.
great.
Or they can, I'm on LinkedIn as well. And I do have, if you Google my name under Flinders, then you can contact me that way as well.
Perfect. That's excellent. We'll provide a couple of links there too. Thank you so much.
It's thank you, Ben. It's been really fun.
This episode was edited by Ryan Manhire, music by Anthem of Rain, sourced from the freemusicarchive.org. You can find me, Ben, on Twitter, @LohmeyerBen. If you like the podcast, please like, share, comment, and do all the things.